Blog Talk Radio.
Alright, welcome to the Bottom Up Radio Network. Happy Motherfucker Day.
The goddamn shame, what's going down? How it got to this, I do not know. There's a sick wind that is blowing round, and the captain's got to go. About you or me, he does not give a damn. What a low down dirty snake, with his mind on his money. Like when the hounds start howling, when there's fiends about, I will stand up and shout. I declare mutiny on this ship. Yeah, the captain's been drinking below the deck, and this vessel headed way off course. I want to wrap my hands around his crooked neck and throw him overboard. Send him to his Lord. Send him to his Lord. Well, I don't want to be sick. No, I just want to be free and take back what these old devils have taken from me. No, I don't want to be saved. Oh, I just want to be free and take back what these old devils have taken from me. Like when the hounds start howling. Oh, when the fiends about.
When the fiends about.
Oh, I will stand up and shout. I declare mutiny on this ship. I said, I declare mutiny on this ship. Well, the captain's been drinking below the deck, and this vessel's headed way off course. I want to wrap my hands around his crooked neck and throw him overboard. Send him to his Lord.
Motherfucker, burn.
That's like a rad song.
Fuck yeah,
like
that whole
it.
Album is fucking delicious. It's a wonderful album.
I
recommend you steal it right now.
Steal it, eat it. Digest.
Well, wait 2 hours. We got a really good show tonight. Then after the show, you'll be so inspired to go steal some shit. You should steal that album first. It's called Animals in the
gotcha.
Dark, William Elliott Whitmore. What's up, G20?
Oh, what's going down? How you doing, Rob?
What do you
want to
fight about tonight?
I want to talk about tonight why
Star Wars or Star Trek.
Yeah, so I was gonna say whether it was a wise choice for James Cameron to edit out the sex scene in Avatar. I really want to dig into that.
Is it bestiality or is it just unity? You know, is it breaking all borders down? Really?
Hey, speaking of bestiality, they recently found some Neanderthal bones in a cave mixed with some what appear to be like human bones, old school style. So I think fucking humans and Neanderthals were fucking back in the dizzy.
Way back when? Well, obviously, I mean, have you seen some of the Marines that we have these days? There's an
They're
obvious
pretty Neanderthal-y.
There. It's an obvious genetic carryover. Big fucking motherfuckers anyway.
Yeah, no shit. Man, I just finished the book, Earth Abides. I highly recommend it to all our listeners. It's by George R. Stewart.
George
R. Stewart. For any of our peeps out there who are really into, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, like tribalism and you know, post-civ and all those things. This book is a, you know, technically it's a, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic kind of futuristic novel, but, you know, really it's incredibly eerie in its realism in terms of, you know, you're with one character the entire book. You're never in anybody else's mind except his. Yeah, it's just really kind of a very realistic novel of what would the last bits of survivors after a huge global plague, you know, the people who live, how would they do it? What would they do? And it's just fascinating shit, really fascinating shit, and beautifully written. And I masturbated on the pages. So when I lend it to you, Rabble Rouser, you'll notice my semen's on it.
Oh, that's cool. That's so cool. I don't need to read all of it. I can leave those pages stuck together.
Yeah, and just know that those are, like, really good parts.
Sweet. What am I reading this week? This week I am reading... I'm doing a reading of Desert Solitaire by Ed
Abbey. What is it again?
Desert Solitaire by Ed Abbey.
Nice.
It's his first major book. The other ones he wrote before that were more Western style books that they based the movies off. But this is the first book that branched into the deep ecology environmentalist action. It's basically just him recounting his time in the Utah deserts and how beautiful it is. And it has quite possibly the greatest line ever written about a book by an author in his introduction. And I'll read that line to you right now just because it's so beautiful. He's talking in reference to people who are going to read this book and want to instantly go out to this beautiful landscape that he describes in these couple hundred pages. But he says, when traces of blood are, let's see, I'll step back a little bit. I'll read this whole last paragraph. Do not jump into your automobile next June and rush out to the canyon country hoping to see some of that which I have attempted to evoke in these pages. In the first place, you can't see anything from a car. You've got to get out of the goddamn contraption and walk, better yet crawl, on hands and knees over the sandstone and through the thorn bush and cactus. When traces of blood begin to mark your trail, you'll see something, maybe. Probably not. In the second place, most of what I write about in this book is already gone or going under fast. This is not a travel guide, but an elegy, a memorial. You're holding a tombstone in your hands, a bloody rock. Don't drop it on your foot. Throw it at something big and glassy. What do you have to lose? Ed Abbey, April 1967. Best line ever. You're holding a tombstone.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, don't drop it on your foot. Throw it at something big and glassy. What do you have to lose?
What if you, dude? What if he was talking about one of his bros who are all high, glassy eyed, fucking. Never mind. All right, just leave me alone.
Stretch. So some reportage, being that we are a news source, and we do have a call already. 917, are you there? And they hung up. I think that may have been, I don't know. I'm guessing that may have been Ben. Hopefully he called
that was
back.
Our guest. He was like, fuck this shit.
He's like, I fucking hate Ed Abbey. I'm hanging up right now.
Yeah, no,
I don't know. 917, if you're listening and you want to call in, call back in. Shit.
Hey, callers, welcome all night, guys.
Yeah, Ben.
And
Ben
to the
questions and...
Yeah, I mean, and to the cops that are listening, thanks for listening. And you can call in, too. You know, we'll talk about, you know, cooperative security, decentralized, and, you know, turn you onto it. We'll educate you.
Well, G20 will talk about that. I'll tell you to fuck yourself, but, yeah. So some news. We all may have or may not have seen. If you haven't seen, you can go on to Bottom Up Radical Network's Facebook page, and check out a video I posted on May Day. Santa Cruz on May Day had a dance party that turned into a political action. We'll call it that. They're calling it a riot. But what happened was 18 businesses on the main strip of Santa Cruz just were felt the wrath of the people of that town. Now, if anybody is not familiar with Santa Cruz, it used to at one time be a really awesome small town on the coast that really held true to its community-based ideals. You know, all of the stores were community-based. This main strip, there was, you know, never shoes were never worn. It was right by the beach, so people didn't wear shoes. They walked in around. They ate at burrito shops. Shirts were hardly ever worn. Homeless people could sleep on the benches. There was great street music. I mean, it was a good place to be. But then over the last 5 years, 5 or 6 years, it's just really turned into a total corporate shithole, a corporate ghetto, if you will, of Urban Outfitters and shit heaps like that. Well, 18 of those stores were destroyed, their windows broken out, graffitied on May Day by masked self-proclaimed anarchists. I love it when the media says that. It's so funny. Wait, actually, Travis, will you do it for me? Will you do how the media guy says anarchists? The news guy. This
yeah.
Anarchists is so good.
Self-proclaimed anarchists broke the window of several stores. And then, you know, and then the graphics, of course, are the parentheses. So I don't know. I mean, are they saying that there are? I mean, what are they suggesting with the parentheses? You know, when they show the graphics and it says anarchists, it's always in parentheses. Do you think that's a way of using language to delegitimize, you know, the anarchist community? To make it seem not real, it's a quote-unquote group of anarchists. Because every time you see them and they put it up on their graphics in text, there's always quotation marks over anarchists.
Right, yeah. Well, it's like, you know, it's like you would, the way I would say, like, you know, the way someone would talk about Middle Earth or something, you know, or like, like you know, the unicorns, you know, quote unquote. You know, yeah, like it's some figment imagination, some fad group or something. I don't know, but
yeah, Rabble Rouser, just we do have a caller with us. 917, are you with us? Are you back on?
I'm here.
Just Ben.
This is Ben.
Hey, what's up, you motherfucker?
Oh well, shit, this motherfucking guy.
So everybody, this is Ben Morea, one time a member of some pretty radical groups in New York, and lately, well, we'll let him tell you about what he's been doing lately, but you may know him from reading the writings of Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, and the artistic manifestos of Black Mask. So thanks, Ben, for joining us tonight. We're doing our news reports right now, so you want to stick around for these and give us some of your input on what's happening. Sound good?
I could do whatever you suggest. Or I could call you, but whatever's convenient.
No, man, stay on. It'd be fun
I'm here.
Yeah, it'd be good to have your voice on these. So the one I was just getting ready to bring up is we're talking about the Santa Cruz riots on May Day. You know, a bunch of corporate businesses were fucked up and destroyed and what was started off as a dance party. And the black blocked tactic was put into play by anarchists there. And now the police there, this is an article I just found. It's called The Anarchist Profile in Santa Cruz. And I'm going to throw that on the chat room so other people can read this. Here we go. Boom, it's in the chat room. So it's called The Anarchist Profile in Santa Cruz. And it starts off, the second paragraph says, World Book defines anarchism as a political theory that promotes the abolition of government and in some cases by violence and terror. That theory was definitely displayed last Saturday with the destruction downtown. It was terror. It was like Al-Qaeda when, you know, the Urban Outfitters window was broken. This was, Osama bin Laden was definitely behind this, people.
Oh, yeah.
Make no mistake about it. These are highly trained 19-year-old kids with bricks.
Yeah, little did we know that the Gap has been hiring them all this time to stock their shelves, and they've been learning how to break their windows. Fucked up.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what anarchists do. You know, we take menial labor jobs, even though we're highly funded, according to Alex Jones, by the feds. We take the barista jobs because, you know, we're trying to learn the ins and outs of the Starbucks before we fucking smash it. But now the police in Santa Cruz are saying that this just isn't enough. We don't have enough people here. We don't have enough resources to stop this. We need the FBI to come in. And they're now working with the FBI using high-tech surveillance capabilities, you know, like computers and whatnot, to analyze the videos and try to get the identities of these masked individuals. The people who, you know, the people who were having a good time and you know, caused a little bit of economic damage to these fuckheads. So the last paragraph of this says, Santa Cruz police say bringing in the FBI to investigate the underground culture is something badly needed after Saturday's attacks. Listen, 18 stores had windows broken. Okay, if you go into any neighborhood that was a poor neighborhood 5 years ago and you look at it now, you see that homes were demolished, completely destroyed. Families were uprooted and moved out. This isn't new either. This isn't just in the last 5 years. This has always been going on, but you can do it now. You can go into your own town and find what was once the poor neighborhood, and you'll see a bunch of fucking art galleries and doggy daycares. And those places were there after massive amounts of destruction took place, done by banks and real estate agents, contractors, all contracting with tax dollars through the funds of the city and the state that were diverted from schools, diverted from mental health programs, diverted from drug addiction facilities, and given to these contractors to build fucking condominiums. Entire neighborhoods were destroyed. A few fucking windows get destroyed, and the FBI is badly needed to investigate the underground culture. It's really funny. And the Chief Rick Martinez said that anarchists are anti-government, anti-establishment, and create a lot of division within the community. The cops don't create the division. No. The gated communities, that's not a division. No.
Well, I want to read a quote from one of the business owners there. This is from it's a great website called Rad Geek People's Daily. It's radgeek.com, cool website. I posted a link in the chat room. But Emily Bernhard, manager at Del Williams Jewelers, was shocked by the event. Her quote is, business owners and Santa Cruz community members alike are focusing their blame on Sub Rosa and Anarchist Cafe, partly because one of the men arrested admitted picking up flyers for the event there. We can't let an anarchist cafe exist now that we know the potential of what they can do and publicize. And the writer Rad Geek says, I don't know why Emily Bernhard thinks that the existence of an anarchist cafe should be subject to her personal sufferance. She manages a business, but she doesn't own downtown Santa Cruz. Sub Rosa pays their rent to a landowner who's willing to have them, and they have as much of a right to be there as anybody else. But in any case, the Sub Rosa community space is being scapegoated, harassed, and targeted by other business owners for eradication for no other reason than the fact that they are anarchists. And I think that's it. I think just the label of it is just, you know, and especially like a jeweler, you know, people need to understand that when they start referencing even local businesses, we're talking about a jeweler. And I don't think we need to waste our fucking time right now explaining why the jewel industry is really, really evil.
I love it when they said family owned, the oldest family owned store in Santa Cruz. And it's like, yeah, blood diamonds. They're selling gold that was mined on indigenous lands. You know, these people aren't your fucking friend. This isn't the fucking cobbler. This isn't, you know, like, this isn't some fucking guy. Jesus Christ. Fuck these motherfuckers. So all props go. You know what? Even if they were paid federal agents, according to Alex Jones, breaking those windows, good on you. Finally, the federal government's using our tax dollars to do some good work and break some fucking windows at some major businesses. Fuck them. Fuck them. That's my tax dollars at work right there. Loving it. So finally, anarchism's a threat again, Ben. What do you think about that?
I think about what?
The anarchism's a threat again.
Well, you know, that's the path to control, is to create fear of somebody. I mean, so they just, it's their way of using anarchists to create the police state. Like, to justify whatever they do. I mean, it's always been that way. They use, like terrorism, Al-Qaeda, they use that to justify destruction of half the world.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, whether or not you believe that Al Qaeda is CIA propped or backed up, it doesn't really matter who created them. What matters is who's profiting from them.
They're using it. It's a tool. And you know, as bad as it is, they're using it for something equally nefarious. And that's why they use the fear of anarchists or whatever the fear of same-sex marriage or the fear of, you know, they use all things that they don't like or understand. They use it to justify their power, their destruction of those things. In the 30s they used it against the Marxists, you know, and I'm not pro-Marxist, but that was the great fear, the red fear, the red threat, the House Un-American Activity Committee.
Sure, and now it's there. You know, in the past 10 or 15 years, it's been the environmentalist threat, the green scare. They've been rounding up environmentalists and demonizing them in the media. I mean, last week we had Trey Arrow.
That terrifies them because there are committed people who feel something needs to be corrected, and they're attempting to do that, and that they're terrified by that. They don't want any of those things corrected.
And I think it's representative of a paradigm shift. I mean, it's one of the most interesting things to me, Ben, is that people are particularly galvanized by a broken window of Bank of America.
Yeah.
Everybody fucking hates Bank of America. Nobody likes Bank of America, but they are so galvanized when that fucking institution.
Window is like a nosebleed. I mean, it's not a serious problem. We have serious.
I don't
problems.
Even think it's a nosebleed to these cats, Ben. I think that this is like their insurance covers that shit, and you know they get billions of dollars from governments. Man, this is the least.
Yeah,
they
don't
like,
have to talk about the oil leak. They don't have to talk about the droning of innocent people because, you know, they don't have to talk about anything real. They just talk about this illusionary threat.
And something I want to talk about with the oil, with this BP thing, I think that's a good time to bring this up because this is part of our whole news, part of our show, because we're fucking news reporters. I was under the impression, and this is my own fucking ignorance, but I was like, oh, okay, it's an oil spill. That's really bad. You know, it's an oil spill. But this is not an oil spill. There's a geyser of oil, even as we speak, pumping up into the ocean.
Right. And it's really could have been prevented. I mean, it's just greed and cost cutting that allowed that to happen.
In
this age of technology, I mean, there could have been so many safeguards. I mean, but they cut costs. That's a minor concern of theirs. Their real concern is to get the oil, and they don't think about the damage that they can cause and spend a little extra money to eliminate damage. But in a way, they shouldn't be oil drilling anyway offshore. So maybe that'll alert people to that reality, why it should not even exist. It may be a blessing in disguise.
Well, that's what old, what's the fat guy's name? Rush Limbaugh was saying that, you know, this is obviously the work of environmental activists who are trying to trying to dissuade us from offshore drilling. Because that's what we do. Like, we recognize the potential danger of industry, and so we create the catastrophes that they would have created eventually anyway, just to prove the point. That's what we do, you know.
They didn't create the catastrophe. Some nefarious gang of black-suited individuals caused the problem. It wasn't
probably those self-proclaimed anarchists.
Yeah, self-proclaimed.
Yeah, quote unquote.
In quotes.
Fuck. So, What was I? Oh yeah, I was talking to my mother today because it is Mother's Day, and all of
right.
you. And I talk to her anyway because she's my mother and I love her. But you know, God bless her. She was telling me I talked about the oil spill. She was like, oh, it's really bad. But did you see what they're doing? It's really neat. They're using human hair caught in these big, really they're like big pantyhose, and it's sucking up the oil. I'm like, Mom, are you fucking serious? Are you kidding? She's like, no, it's really neat. You should watch it. It's really neat. Like, so apparently this is one of their big tactics, their big cleanup things, is to get these really long nylon tubes full of human hair that they
right.
then corral the oil in.
And
well, that's because they're going green. That's because they're going green. So
right.
And then they want you to be favorable toward them because they're doing such a good cleanup job. Not,
right.
Not that they caused the problem to begin with.
Right. Of course, it's the same people that profited from building the oil drill that are going to profit from cleaning up the fucking mess. It's
right.
Halliburton.
Exactly.
It's the same fucking people. You know,
right.
They're fucking you from both ends, and they're loving every minute.
Right.
They're doing it with corporate welfare. You know, all this talk about welfare being bad, all this socialism.
Right.
Talk, these are the biggest proponents of socialism, and these are the fucking socialists. Like, are you kidding me? Like,
yeah.
These assholes live off of our fucking labor. Like, it's always
right.
the poor
it's
that feed the rich. Always. Absolutely.
Always.
Never. As long as civilizations have existed, it's always the poor that have fed the rich. Fuck them. I say starve them. Fuck them.
Yes, but the question is, how do you do that?
I don't know. Bricks through windows is a fun way to take, start, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tax dodge, you know, no more taxes.
You get a lot of broken glass, and that's about it. It's
right.
it's a dilemma. I mean, we know what it has to be changed, stopped, but it's very difficult to figure out what that process is.
I mean, I've been thinking lately about just like, my wife and I today were out back and we're digging up a plot and, you know, we're, beginning to plant stuff. Yeah, I killed a guy again. we're going to start growing our own food and doing all these things. And by the way, before I forget, because Ben, in my defense, I smoke tons of pot and I constantly forget to tell people shit that I plan on telling them because my memory sucks. Anyway, that said, people in New York, to our listeners in New York and LA, there's actually, particularly those big cities, there's actually a pretty strong movement of backyard urban gardening starting and vertical wall gardening and stuff. And that's just a little, tiny little thing in the whole broad fabric of resistance and change. But, you know, I think biggest things that helps keep these industries and keeps us giving so much power to these groups is food. You know, Daniel Quinn goes back to this so much in his books, is the whole notion of keeping food under lock and key, you know, of hoarding just food, beginning with that. I think that's one of the major areas in which we've become so intertwined with these incredibly powerful groups because they all play such a strong role in controlling our food.
But
and that really fucks us up.
When controlling the water, that's when it's going to really...
And that's already starting. I mean, I was in Arizona last fall, and everyone I met was drinking huge racks of bottled water. I mean, they were already willingly giving money to the water barons.
Right. $15 billion a year spent in America on bottled water. $15
billion. Jesus Christ. I fucking hate white people.
You know what you can do to ameliorate the problems in the world with $15 billion?
That's a lot of guns.
And they're just using it to, you know, for water. But that's going to be, you know, oil is a minor issue compared to what water is going to be. Because you can live without oil, but you can't live without water.
Right.
And that's in 10, 20 years, that's going to be the real battleground.
Well, you know what's interesting about that is if you read about a lot of the indigenous cultures, the names that the indigenous cultures, if they gave themselves a name at all, the names that they chose were always named after the water of some sort, where they were located by their water and how they consumed, whether they ate fish, whether they drank from springs or drank from rivers. This is where their names related to, especially in the West. And that's what gave, you know, people always think, you know, why would they fight so bad against these people to defend this? Well, because they're defending what gave them life. They're defending that which they come from. They come from the water.
Health.
Right. And so the thing is, we don't even know where our water comes from. If you ask anybody in the city where their water comes from, what springs it comes from, what rivers it comes from, they don't know. They just know it comes from the tap. And so when you talk about food under lock and key, you know, this is the amazing thing is they don't even have to put food under lock and key. Remember G20 when we had Joel Salatin on, and he said that they went to the food bank and there
right.
were 1,400 pounds or something like that, or 400. It was 400 pounds of sweet potatoes that nobody was taking because nobody knew how to prepare sweet potatoes. They don't even have
right.
to lock the food up. People don't even know how to fucking cook. They don't know how to prepare food.
Oh, no.
So you don't even, that's what the real thief is, the thievery of experience. And I think Artie Lang really hit it well in The Politics of Experience when he talks about that. And the taking away of the people's experience. So what I want to talk about is experience. And, Ben, that's why I wanted you on the show tonight, because you have a lot more experience than most of us these days in what has worked, what's been fun, what's been exciting about not anarchism, but anarchy, like making anarchy a way of life and an action. I want to talk about, like, can you tell people what the roots were of Black Mask, which then became the family and the motherfuckers and so on? Like, can you start from the beginning and just fucking let it out? Give us some history here.
Well, all right. Black Mask was an attempt to use art in a more politicized social way, like to understand art as a key, like creativity of mankind has always been key, and so it was an attempt to, like following the path that the Dadaists and Surrealists, to see that art as an act in itself of rebellion. And then it just kept evolving because the everyday issues of war and racial unrest were so dominant that it just shifted into the family, which was more political and less artistic, even though we were still artists and we approached the revolution as an artistic event. It was more mundane, unless in the realm of creativity, of art creation. And so the events of the day just caused us to take that approach, because we felt that something had to be changed, you know, stop. Like the racial problem had to be solved and the war had to be ended, and it, you know, we were just sucked into the daily events, and so
it was an organic shift from
totally organic
art.
I can't even tell you the date it happened or how it happened.
Let's set this in the scale for people. When did Black Mask begin publishing the first magazine and doing the first guerrilla art?
You know, I'm really bad on dates, and you have to excuse me, but I think it was 66 was the first issue. 66, 67, right in there.
So 43, 44 years ago.
Right.
And this is in the midst of you got the civil rights movement that it was,
right.
It was pretty big at that time. You got the Vietnam War that was really growing.
Right.
You got hippies and the counterculture. You got
right.
the beatniks have all grown their
right.
hair out. So there's already a consciousness shift going on in the country. There's the 50s model America is no longer being promoted. It's now more of a social revolution that's taking place.
Right.
So why Black Mask? Why the family? Why the motherfuckers? I mean, wasn't there already a shift happening? Like, I think that's the dominant idea is that the 60s were just revolution was in the air and it was everywhere. You had all these groups pop up.
Right, but we felt we had to find an arena that we as individuals could contribute. And that's where, so art, since we were coming from the artistic creative world, we felt that we wanted to contribute to this social unrest through art, but slowly it morphed into a more political need. Never excluding art, but it was that was no longer the key focus.
Do you think that that was a good organic shift, or do you think that taking
it's neither good or bad. It was real. I mean, there was no way. At some point, you just have to look around you and say, what we're doing is great, but something else has to happen. Something immediate has to happen. And, I'm not saying that everybody should make that shift, but we felt we had to. So, and it was evolutionary. I mean, we didn't sit down and make a theoretical decision. It just slowly evolved. Like, more and more people were attracted to Black Mask, and that had a more overtly political consciousness. We became more involved with the daily struggles of civil rights and the war, anti-war. But we wanted to use the tools that we were adept at, which was artistic, guerrilla theater. Besides guerrilla politics, we wanted to keep guerrilla theater in there. Like, the Marxist approach was just too stultifying for us. So we didn't want to leave the political arena to them exclusively. We felt that creative people had to enter that as well. Because, I mean, ultimately, the Marxists were just going to lead us down the same path of control and power, except they were going to they wanted to replace the capitalists, but they wanted the power. So we felt we as creative people could add another worldview. And
Ben, I wanted to ask you a question about the famous story about you guys storming the music venue and demanding once a week free night of music.
Right.
At that venue. And my perspective, of course, is that if you don't like an institution, then just build your own with your friends and as a cooperative. But why storm the venue and make that demand? What was your purpose? What did you feel?
Well, we did what you just suggested as well. I mean, we had free concerts. Like, for instance, the Lower East Side was a ghetto, but it was occupied by the Flower Children, the hippie, but also by Black and Puerto Rican minorities. And so we put on concerts in the park that combined all three to show that there was some common thread, that they weren't exclusive of each other. I mean, we never focused on one approach only. So the Fillmore was important, but we didn't put all of our effort into getting the Fillmore free. That was just a parallel to having our own concerts and in the park. I mean, so we really tried a multifarious approach, like. And we felt that the Fillmore was benefiting from the culture, the youth culture. And so we felt they should return something to that community. I mean, it was just a logical approach that if they're going to make money off the youth culture, they should give these dropout kids a free night. And not just the suburban kids that come in for the music on the weekends.
Can you tell us what that looked like? That occupation of the stage, and because that's the reason I asked that is what we see now is a borderline insurrectionary philosophy that's really getting worked on in anarchist communities all over the U.S. And what that's looking like is less and less creative, and more overtly destructive.
That's a danger.
Yeah,
it's self-defeating.
It's boring.
It's self-defeating.
And it's boring. It's like,
yeah.
I like a good march as much as the next person. I like the sound of broken bank windows as much as the next guy. I like
there's got to be more to it than that.
Right, that's not who we are. That's just something that we should do every once in a while.
That's
an
aside. That's a footnote.
Right.
And, like, the Living Theater was performing at the Fillmore. Judith Molina and Julian Beck. They were friends of mine. When I was 17, I went and stayed around them. They were the people who made me understand what anarchism was. I knew I was a rebel at 17, but I didn't understand the philosophy of anarchism. It was through them that they put the name to it. But anyway, they were performing this many years later, and I went to them and told them our plan was to hold the theater. So I told them, at the end of your performance, don't leave the stage, and we're going to make an announcement. And we had a mimeograph machine in the audience, and we printed up flyers saying what we were doing. And we thought it was everything we did, we felt should be fun. And we thought that was fun. So,
now, to give people an idea, a lot of people don't know, unfortunately, what the Living Theater is. It was the first pro-queer, pro-anarchist theater. Began, I think it started in the 1930s, didn't it?
No, in the 40s.
40s,
it was
okay.
The most, it really blossomed in the 50s. It was the first, it was the most radical theater experience in America.
This was that broke down the fourth wall. It was participatory.
They moved the event into the audience. They did. I mean, they were just totally revolutionary, creative people, and they were trying to break down the walls and barriers that left theater as a commodity. They wanted to use theater as a tool for freeing the mind and or the body. All of us realize that commodity has to be a fact, and so they felt that they wanted to free theater from being a commodity. They wanted to make it a exploratory, free tool. And they were extremely creative, beautiful people. They were from the Beatnik era, and I don't think they're known enough in America what they did. They did some remarkable things.
And they still are. They're still hosting the Anarchist Art Festival, and every year we played there. Our band
away,
there last year.
Living, yeah. They're downtown.
She's great.
Yeah. And
Julian Beck said one of the best things I've ever heard. He said we've discovered what the enemy is, and it's not what we thought, but the enemy
right.
is money
exactly.
itself. Everybody started burning money. It was
yeah.
The enemy isn't greed, the enemy is money. Like it was a really amazing turn that I think people need to internalize or could internalize.
Ben, in the chat room, Radio Free Nation has a question. I want you to talk a little bit about the Weather Underground.
Well, talk about them in what sense? I mean, we knew them, but we had different, they were more Leninist, and we felt, but they were friends of ours. We really liked them. We loved them. But we didn't think their approach was correct. And in the beginning, before they were the Weathermen, they hung around with us, and they really picked up on our style of total abandonment, you know, and being non-Marxist, and they slowly evolved into a Leninist approach, and which we really didn't feel comfortable with. They saw themselves as a vanguard, and we really objected to that idea of a vanguard.
In Mark Rudd,
the vanguard then becomes the new power. That's what happened with Lenin. He was a vanguard, and it led to Stalin. So theoretically, ideologically, we really opposed that to that approach. But we admired them in their effort to tackle this problem, this monster that at that time that was threatening the world. And even more so in a way now. But we didn't agree with it. If that's what your questioner wanted, that I'm not sure if that's what he was looking for.
That's exactly. They were just wondering, you know, what you knew about them, what your experience with them was.
The thing with our family, like Abby Hoffman. Like, we didn't agree with his approach. It was much too media-oriented. But we liked him. He was a friend. And Murray Bookchin, we didn't agree with him. He was a Trotskyist in anarchist clothing. But we liked him. I mean, that's the thing about our family. We didn't have an ideological approach. We saw it as a human endeavor. We were all trying to tackle this monster. And we liked all of these people, even though we disagreed with their approach.
It's definitely not what we're seeing happen now in the anarchist community. It's what a few of us...
Yeah, no, that's a danger.
Yeah, especially those of us who've been around it for, 10 or 15 years, we see it getting to a point where you see a lot of the vanguardist ideas coming forth. And the big one for me, the big thing that really shoots it off is the meetings, constantly having meetings. And one of the things that I read about the motherfuckers was that you never had
a meeting. Talk
about spontaneity and talk about,
And we did for instance, the name and using that identity, you did not have to get anybody's permission to do that. I mean, all of the people that associated with the family, that were part of the family in the loose sense, they could do something or decide to do something, put out a leaflet, sign that name. They didn't have to come and ask a central committee. And we thrived on that. We just believed, it's just like cutting the fences in Woodstock. The kids that had the fence cutters, they didn't ask a central committee if they agreed with that approach, which they did, which we did, as the older members of the family thought it was the greatest idea, and we jumped right in with them. But they just got the wire cutters and planned to do this. They didn't ask our permission, the older family members. I mean, there was no authority whatsoever within our family. And it was a role model. I don't know if you can build a world movement on that, but it was important to us to show that was an alternative. And we lived that way. We believed in that self-regulation, autonomy of the individual.
Yeah, because I feel like we've mixed we've kind of lost track of the notion of what free association, what the implications of that concept are, and the bureaucracy has seeped into our lives like to such a degree. Like I feel saturated in it. I mean, I see not only infighting amongst anarchists struggling and to define what an anarchist is and declaring who is and who is not an anarchist, you know, and there's a lot of that going on. And I think sometimes that notion is maybe a little bit inflated, and maybe I think because that might be a little bit related to the information age and the fact that, like, you know, on an internet forum, you might have two or three assholes who say a bunch of stupid shit. But if you're not familiar with anarchism, you might walk away from it with a distorted image of it. You know, like lots of information doesn't mean insight necessarily.
Right. And you know, that's an ongoing problem. But that, up until recently, that was the problem amongst Marxists. But anarchists have had that problem in the past, and I think you're right. It is growing now. I see that internecine battles more and more within. But we really felt that was itself a problem to demand a unified ideological approach to anything, rather than just to see the struggle as the need.
Well, I think the basis for that happening is the history that we see now. That anytime there has been collusion with anarchists and, let's say, communists, Marxists, Trotskyists, they always try to co-opt, like the ISO, the International Socialist Organization, and groups like that. They always try to co-opt and then control what happens. They use their party programming and try to exert that upon the movement or upon any actions that the anarchists take. And so then there'll be an action where both parties are present, but then the ISO or one of these fucking Marxists sees a camera and they jump at the fucking chance to talk to the media.
Right.
And then they tell the media, you know, they denounce the anarchists for the anarchist action, and then they say that they organized the meeting. It's just, you know, it's like, I don't really care that they say they organized it, like, but I don't want to be co-opted in any way or associated in any way with those doctors. Like,
in the past, it was even worse than co-option. It was death. Like in Spain, for instance, the Salinists executed anarchists.
Sure.
They had a common enemy and a common struggle, but the Stalinists wanted to control that struggle, and so they sentenced anarchists to firing squads. I had friends of mine that were on a firing squad that were standing against the wall, ready to be shot, and that the anarchists came over the wall and saved them. They were going to be killed by Stalinists.
You talk about that. I read in an interview that you talk about a lot of the inspiration, or at least a lot of your kinship at the time in the 60s was Spanish anarchists from the Spanish Revolution. And
Rudy people.
Yeah, how did that play into having a multi-generational resistance and people who have been through it? Did they help guide young anarchists like yourself?
No, they were completely fearful of it.
Really?
They didn't see. They had no cultural approach whatsoever. Like the younger anarchists had a cultural side, and the older anarchists had none whatsoever. And
wow!
So
it seems.
They were more a political ideology. They really were. Like, they didn't see the struggle in the world as having a cultural need. They didn't smoke dope. They didn't, you know, they were elder people, and they had a very restricted view of what change meant. They were fearful of change. They were just as fearful of change as the people who opposed the anarchists. But, but we learned a lot from them in terms of their determination and their valor. And they were just beautiful. They were, you know, and we like being around them and hearing the stories of Spain, and I'm beginning to, and understanding the difference between them and the Lincoln Brigade helped us, the difference between them and the Stalinists. You know, it just made us realize a lot of the potential disagreements that we were going to face in the future.
And you did face.
And we did face. But we always ignored that. I mean, we just, the counterculture, the hippies, were somewhat fearful of us because we had a violent streak, and the politicals hated us. So we really had like this isolated, unique view. And I think it was important that somebody represented that amalgamation of culture and politics. And I think we were an important factor in the 60s because of that.
Well, we're at the top of the hour right now. We're going to take a really short break to play a clip by Submedia TV, and then when we come back, Ben, open the phone lines, take some callers with some questions, and talk about, I'd like to talk about what how it all fell apart and the splitting out.
I don't really think it fell apart. It just evolved again.
Well, I'm not necessarily
we'll
just
talk
talking
about
up against the wall, but yeah,
oh, yeah.
I want you to talk express that. But like, I'm talking about how the seemingly unified but diverse group you had. You know, you had the motherfuckers, you had SDS, you had the Underground, you had the Black Panthers, you had the Latin Kings, and then the splits that started taking place, the challenges that came up, and the COINTELPRO, and just all that other bullshit. Because I mean, you know, to be honest, you're the one of the only people over the age of 50 who still calls himself an anarchist that I know.
I'm going to be 70 next year.
Yeah, there you go. So let's talk about that, because I know, like,
okay.
I read.
So
Mark,
do you want me to call you back?
No, stay on the line if you don't mind. Do you mind staying on the line?
I do not mind, but I didn't know what was more convenient for you.
Oh, yeah, no, stay on the line. This clip is from Submedia TV's latest clip. Is called Overthrow the Government. So we'll be back on the other side of this clip. And just to let everybody know, too, this is Franklin Lopez's show. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. And Byrne is really happy to be a part of a group that gets to work with directly with Submedia, and we're going to be doing some fucking cool shit together in the future, so keep your ears tuned to that. But stay on, and callers, please call in after the break. We'll have some questions you can talk to Ben, and we'll get this thing going.
This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Thank you very much.
This is the tracks of an armored personnel carrier that have just been broken off. The whole column of military vehicles here that have simply been abandoned. That's how fierce the fighting was and how quickly the soldiers had to retreat. This is an extraordinary sight in the historic old part of Bangkok, the capital city of Thailand. Clashes, Thai on Thai. And this was the result, the security forces beating a retreat, leaving their equipment behind.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where sticks and stones will break your bones. I'm your host, The Stimulator, and I bet y'all never thought you'd see images like these. Yep, that indeed is a massive line of riot pigs that is running away from the motherfucking Kyrgyz resistance, who this month overthrew the government and chased the president out of the country and into Kazakhstan.
He's nice.
Apparently President Bekiev is a holdover from the commie era, and who, after consolidating power, pushed around independent journalists and jailed members of the opposition. Bekiev was able to get away with this bullshit because he acted as a shit sherpa for the motherfucking United Snakes. You see, when you allow the empire to rock a military base on your land so that Obama can keep killing the brown man in Afghanistan, well, you can get away with murder. But the Kyrgyz have shown us that it is possible to knock down the dickwads up top. Let's watch the shit again. Fucking awesome.
I joined the Red Church because I want to be part of the people power that returns this country to the real people.
Another powerful example of David versus Goliath is the motherfucking Thai Resistance, aka the Red Shirt Movement. The Red Shirts are made up of mostly rural farmers who are sick and tired of being ignored by the pubic enemas who run the Southeast Asian country. The Prime Minister has refused to negotiate with the Red Shirts, so they decided to negotiate with his vehicle instead. The battle for Bangkok is not over, but we'll keep you updated to any new developments. In Bolivia, leaders from the Global South took part in a People's Conference on Climate Change. Here's Bolivian President Evo Morales on the opening day.
We have two paths, either Pachamama or death. We have two paths, either capitalism dies or Mother Earth dies. Either capitalism lives or Mother Earth lives. Of course, brothers and sisters, we are here for life, for humanity, and for the rights of Mother Earth.
Evo is correct. If we want to have a planet to gangsta chill on, we need to slay capitalism. But, like most things that seem too good to be true, El Señor Morales has his own contradictions to contend with. The indigenous president is betting his country's future on oil and gas extraction, mining, dams, and even building coal-fired power plants. Hardly a green-friendly strategy if you ask me. To make matters worse for him, while the climate summit was kicking off, indigenous peeps in the south of Bolivia shut down a mine run by the
Sumitomo Corporation.
Sumitomo Shoji no Kato desu.
The mission of the Sumitomo Corporation is to achieve prosperity and realize dreams through sound business activities.
Well, domo arigato, motherfucker. Apparently, in order to extract minerals, the Sumitomo-run mine sucks about 600 liters of water every single motherfucking minute, and the protesters want that water back. A similarly fucked up situation is going down in BC, where the crotch-burning crack tokers from Taseko Mines want to drain the beautiful fish lake so that they can fill it with mining waste. Well, as expected, the industry suck-ups who run the province of British Columbia have approved the mining project. Here's Taseko Mines rat bastard in charge, Russell Halbauer, explaining why he expects the Canadian federal government to approve the mine as well.
Because the federal process and the provincial process are essentially identical. So we have made 103 commitments to environmental protection, and we believe those will be replicated and harmonized with the federal process. So we see no reason why there will be any stumbling blocks with respect to the feds approving this. So we will move forward with whatever we can to accelerate the build out of this of the mine.
But according to local residents, the environment will not be protected, and the fish for which the lake is named after could be endangered. Here's former Chief Roger Williams.
Well, we do have a big concern because you put a mine here, and I know, I can guarantee there will be damage. And if that damage leaks, we do know that you're looking at the different lands below Fish Lake going towards the Taseko River.
For those of you in Vancouver who are outraged at this destructive act, Taseko Mines is conveniently located in the heart of downtown, just blocks away from public transit.
Yeah, kick them up and then you know. Let them off the float and bait them with the dough. You can do it drunk or do it disco. Yeah, disco. Find me ways to get a CEO. Flap them up and shake them up and then you know. Let them off the float and bait them with the dough. You can do it drunk or do it disco. Yeah, disco. Worth you waiting. On the turf debating how to get it percolating. You working, you while we happy just to work a day. But I'ma slap until my blood starts circulating. Do you check that elasticity? Did they cut off your electricity? Did you scream and yell explicitly? Force the boss into complicity. I'm a white chalk sizzle, but I push a pencil. Rolling dope fiend rentals to your residential. Broke as fuck eating lentils with no utensil. Finna teach pimp class with a whole credential. They own sweatshops, pet cops, and filter cola. Murder babies with their molars on the areola. Control the Pope, Dalai Lama, holy rollers, and the Ayatollah. Bump this rolling in your bunker or your new Corolla.
As I have reported on numerous occasions on this motherfucking show, indigenous folks everywhere are engaged in acts of resistance against capitalism, occupation, cultural genocide, and environmental destruction. But these acts of rebellion by the original inhabitants of Turtle Island are not new, and date back from the very early days of the first European invaders. To find out more about this rich history, I spoke with Gord Hill, author of 500 Years of Indigenous Resistance. Hey Gord, how the fuck are you?
I'm doing good.
So, 500 years of indigenous resistance. Just what the fuck do you mean?
Well, 500 years of indigenous resistance is basically a history of indigenous resistance against European colonialization here in the Americas. And, I mean, one of the purposes of it was so that indigenous peoples could have a better understanding of that history to counter the colonial history that we're taught in schools and through, you know, pop culture, corporate culture, and to counter this image or this myth that indigenous peoples were simply overwhelmed and crushed by indigenous European civilization, or that they welcomed it and were these, you know, equal partners in this process of the merging of these cultures.
And what was the first instance of natives giving the finger to the white man?
The first recorded, documented resistance was by the Taino. When Columbus left the Dominican Republic, Haiti, which he called Hispaniola, he left a detachment of Spanish conquistadors on the island, and they were instructed to construct a fort and to begin taxing the local population and setting up for the return of Columbus with a much larger force, which he did a couple years later. Well, when he returned, he found that the detachment that he'd left had been killed and the fort that they had constructed had been burned down because the Taino had retaliated against the aggression carried out by the conquistadors.
So you also took this text and made it into a graphic novel called The 500 Years of Resistance comic book. What the fuck?
Yeah, the 500 Years of Resistance comic book is basically retelling the story of the 500 Years of Resistance, which the text tells. But yeah, it just takes it and puts it into a comic book format, which is much more accessible to children, youth, and people who have just generally a hard time sitting down reading a book.
What is your favorite recent example of natives battling it out with settlers?
Well, I think one of the most important examples of current indigenous resistance was the Oka Crisis of 1990. The Mohawks of Ganasitagi, a small territory reserve near the township of Oka, were resisting the expansion of a golf course and a condominium setup that was going to infringe on some of the last remaining pines, wooded area that they used for their ceremonies, lacrosse, and part of their graveyard was contained in this area. So in 1989, 1990, they started campaigning to stop this. They organized protests. They had petitions. They went to city council in Oka to try to stop this expansion, and the city was just arrogant and just would not listen to the people. They began a blockade of a small dirt road in the pines in Ganasitagi, and they maintained this this little blockade for a few months. The township of Oka tried to get a court injunction to order its removal, and on July 11th, the Quebec Provincial Police sent in a large, heavily armed force of tactical officers armed with M16s and tear gas and that, and they went to dismantle this peaceful blockade. But by that time, warriors had rallied to the defense of this blockade and this struggle to protect the pines. And so behind the protesters, there were armed warriors. And when the police came in shooting tear gas, the warriors engaged them in a short firefight, and one of the police officers was shot and killed. After this shootout, the Quebec police retreated. They abandoned most of their vehicles, and this began a 77-day armed siege of the Mohawk community in Ganasetagi. That same morning, Mohawks in Ganawagi seized the Mercier Bridge, also with arms. They seized the Mercier Bridge to place, as an act of solidarity, but also to place pressure on the Quebec government, because the Mercier Bridge was a vital commuter link into Montreal from the suburbs. And, I mean, 100,000 people a day were using this bridge to get to work and to do their business in the city and that. This siege began. There were thousands of police deployed. Eventually, after a few, 2 or 3 weeks, the Canadian Armed Forces were deployed. They deployed an entire brigade of 4,500 troops, complete with armored units, armored personnel carriers, tanks, helicopters, jets, artillery units, and naval forces as well, to contain these two communities of Ganasetagi and Ganawagi. And there was mass rioting by the white Quebecois Chateauguay, residents of Chateauguay, a nearby town, demanding that the military go in and crush this uprising. So it really inflamed a lot of the local racial tensions. Across the country, there was a widespread solidarity movement that arose to defend the Mohawks and to there was protests all across the country, occupations of government offices, occupations and shutting down of bridges, railway lines. There was sabotage, electrical pylons were downed, bridges were burned. So the government of Canada was facing an insurgency that was arising from this standoff. And this was the main contributing factor, of course, that limited the military violence by the government. And the 77-day siege ended when the armed Mohawks burned their weapons and walked out of the final area that they had been contained in. But they refused to surrender, and they got into clashes with the military and the police as they tried to enter this area. But that was the ending of the 77-day siege. Something like 30 or 40 of these people were later acquitted on the grounds of self-defense in court. And the golf course and the condominium project were never expanded. So the Mohawks were victorious. And not only were they victorious in their local struggle, but they helped inspire Indigenous resistance and set the tone for Indigenous resistance throughout the rest of the decade of the 1990s and even up to this day.
Thanks, Gord. And that about does it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. Muchas gracias to all my compañeros who gave me some dinero so that I can continue running my filthy fucking mouth. Paul, Gordon, Michael, Margaret, Laura, Ryan, Stephen, Jeremy, Brandon, David, Sanford, Cynthia, Noah, Dan, Mike, Rodney, Peter, Casey, and Sakura. Humflower. For links to Indigenous resistance or to come in on this show, just visit my fucking website, stimulator.tv. Now go out and visit some CEOs.
Remember, kids, you can podcast high-quality video of this show at submedia.tv.
All right, so that was the end of the world as we know it, and I Feel Fine. And I don't need to say that, though, because you fucking know that already, because you just listened to it as well as I did. So we're back. We got Ben Morea of Black Mask and Up Against the Wall, motherfucker. But, you know, Ben, I hate introducing you as that because that's been 40 years. So, I mean, what's going on in the meantime? What's going on now? Hello?
Yes.
So I was just saying how I hate having to introduce you as Ben Maria from Black Mask and Up Against the Wall, motherfucker, because that's, I mean, those are two obviously really instrumental points of the living history that we have. But what's been 40 years ago? So what's going on? What's happened in the last 25, 30 years?
Well, that's a complicated question. At some point in 1969, after we cut Woodstock fences, and things just reached a point where a lot of my family decided to go into the back to the land efforts and spread out throughout the country. I went into the mountains. I lived for 5 years on horseback, and I stayed in the mountains. See, our struggle was, as you know, multifarious. So there was a political side, there was an artistic side, and there was cultural side. But I, as a person, myself, I always felt that there was a fourth element that I didn't quite understand where it fit in and how it would evolve, and that was the spiritual side. I really felt that religion had destroyed the ability to see the need for spirituality because we were so anti-religious. So I wanted to understand, and I went into the mountains and I spent 5 years and I tried to understand what that meant. And so for 35 years, I have been involved with different, primarily Native efforts. And at some point recently, I'd say three years ago, I felt that in the 60s I had joined the effort to change society, and I felt at some point recently that society actually, if anything, was worse now than it was then, and so I re-entered. And it's only 3 years ago that I became available, either to meet people, talk to people. I'm doing a blog now. So I re-entered that social arena. But prior to that, for 35 years, I was on another, I feel equally important, but somewhat different effort. I don't know how, that's about as concise. It's hard.
That makes perfect sense. I think that's not just a singular struggle either. I don't think that's completely unique. I think, a lot of us come into radical politics at a young age, and we were born and raised into the church, by the church, of course, from our perspective as white males in America, the Christian church, but we obviously rebel against that because it's a bullshit, fucked up institution.
Right.
But in doing that, we give away all concepts,
correct,
of spirituality and connection, and reclaiming it is something that's really hard, and it's embarrassing at times, and sadly
extremely
enough,
extremely hard. It's extremely hard, and it is embarrassing, and it tends to alienate other people if you even approach. But I felt at some point to move forward, we're going to have to understand it.
Absolutely. I feel lucky enough to have a family that helped with that right away. My wife and my children really helped me to recapture that, getting out into nature and understanding, life and death. And before that, I think I just understood death, and I understood death very well. I had a lot of junkie friends. I was a junkie for a long time.
I was a junkie too.
Yeah, and I think you get pretty familiar with the death concept, and it's not something you're afraid of or something you're unfamiliar with as a junkie. But but you forget about life, I think. And you know, I think that's probably, you said equally important, but I think it's probably of the utmost importance that we reconnect with the land and we reconnect with ourselves and a spiritual connection, because that gives us a greater ability to fight. You know, it's unfortunate that people have to wait so often until later in life to do that.
Right. And I think
we've had people on the show say, you know, think about, we've had listeners who just have put out there, you know, ask yourself, you know, within a 100-mile radius, how many people are there that you would trust your life to? And, you know, like I, as much of an individualist as I am, you know, I still can't ignore the importance of connecting with, you know, with connecting with the land and connecting with our friends, and just enriching those relationships. I think that our culture has, especially in America, and especially with capitalism as the big top dog in school, we've become completely accustomed to this sense of entitlement, to being completely disconnected with our friends and our family. And I think that is a really, it's a major disease, because as you know, collapse and decline continue, because that's the nature of civilization, is collapse. You know, so many people are going to have this oh fuck moment, and I would hope that I'm not one of them. You know, I was just remember recently just telling my mom, I was like, you know, mom, you live in the desert. You should move up here where we can grow shit. You know, like our families are completely, everybody lives all over the place. I got family in Kentucky. I've got family in the fucking South. And it's like,
yeah,
Jesus Christ. It's like a diaspora.
I like that. I think that's a strength. I like knowing that all over the world I have people who I can crash anywhere I need to. I can be fed. I think that's one of the strengths of the anarchist community and the punk rock community that I came up in. You know, I came up in a community of truly radical nature that was, you know, it was post whatever the social revolutions were of the 60s and 70s, and it was almost a revolt against that, against
right.
Free love, free hippie, you know, get fucked up right. And forget about yourself and forget about responsibility. And punk rock really came in and real DIY ethics into it. So I because of those connections, I have friends and family for 20 years now. I live all over the fucking world. I like
yeah.
that. I like that separation to a sense. But I do think that, yeah, we do have to have important. It's important to have communities. But I think that, you know, that will come organically as well.
It has to.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. One of the questions that one of the listeners in the chat room had was, in reference to Black Mask and some of the guerrilla tactics, such as making up flyers for art events and handing them to homeless that offered free booze, and just those kind of things to kind of open up, you know, almost hilarity, but also like real impact on the bourgeois rich, you know, art types of the time to bring
right.
in the poor,
right.
as opposed to the other way around. What's
right.
They want to know about that. Like, what kind of stuff happened? What other kind of tactics of that nature happened?
Well, that was an important and consistent. But like we assassinated Koch, the poet, with blanks to show. You know, as an anti-bourgeois political, poetical event.
He passed out, right?
Yeah, he fainted, and people thought he was actually dead. I mean, but we were just always looking for some way to upset the apple cart. I mean, we never, in all honesty, and some people may not like this, but we never saw that our struggle was going to bring about a regime change. We didn't see that as imminent. That we wanted to change, to shake up the way of thinking that would eventually lead to some possibility for real change. But we were in the infant stage, where it was more important for us to shake up the mind and the cultural view of the world and the priorities that were so just completely out of whack. I mean, it wasn't like we see. That's where like Marxists and they thought they were going to actually form a government, as opposed to. But we were just trying to undermine the whole concept of capitalism and authority. We just wanted to put power back into the hands of the individual and show that there were options, and that would eventually lead to some kind of real change. But we didn't see that as imminent. We never thought like the Vanguard people did.
You know, Ben, that's an important thing because, you know, one of the things that I get asked a lot is, you know, when I defend the Black Bloc and all my friends and people I know who are highly intelligent, you know, doctors, garbage men, lawyers, all sorts of people who are part of the anarchist community. And when, you know, when they ask, I get that question a lot, is do they really hope to change people's minds with it? And, you know, I think it's part of our, you know, I have a huge problem with the mass movement culture that we're in, because there's this notion that if we're going to affect change, then we have to do some big thing all at once as a unified mass body. And I think that that kind of change, widespread change, can happen. But I think it's, you know, I really like Rabble Rouser's answers, because fuck them, that's why. And I think that's perfectly appropriate with what we're doing, because, you know, I think one of the whole ideas of bringing about the free society is to live freely, and if that means if that means you need to storm the Fillmore,
right. And you don't want to substitute one power elite for another, which you know that's the dream of a lot of political movements, is they want to be the power.
Yeah, fuck power. Period. Like,
right.
There's an internal power that we can grasp in, of ourselves and of our own life. That's the most power anyone should have, is the power to control their own life. Other than that,
right.
Like,
and
fuck
so we,
power.
Yeah, and we have to evolve some system which allows people to have the most self-regulation and most power over their own life. We, you know, we're going to have to eventually come to some societal blueprint. But at first, the first thing is to show how important it is to be an autonomous being and a self-regulatory being and a free being, and then slowly find what that blueprint will be that will allow society to be that way. And it's a long process.
One of the things I tell people is you know, when we talk about anarchism and we start talking about evidence, and, you know, you get into the theoretical discussions. They happen to me all the time, the theoretical discussions. It's, yeah, anarchism, but then what? You know, what's it look like? And what I tell people is I say, well, you know, it's all around you. In fact, you've probably, any of our listeners right now or anybody they know, chances are have committed at least one act of anarchism today. You know, at some point you had a moment where there was free association taking place. It happens a lot more than we think. And I think that there's that the hierarchy is so firmly implanted in our minds that we directly associate order and harmony directly with the hierarchy. Is the only way that can manifest is through the pyramid. So anarchism being the antithesis to that sounds like chaos, when in fact we're arguing that this is long-term sustainable community development and social experimentation. I mean, I know that myself, I don't argue for any particular type of social system. I just want to see a fucking lot of them. And I want little, small, localized network communities all doing their own thing. And
that's exactly what, you know, many of us want. I mean, we, you know, you hit it on the head. I mean, that's what we're striving for, and it's a long, long process. I you know, it's not going to be in our lifetime, but by each generation living to the max that process, it'll slowly be supplanted in people's mind that it is a possibility that we don't need the hierarchy.
I think that's the fight, is for the possibilities. Like, the people ask, you know, what, you know, okay, anarchism, and then what? It's like, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then what? The possibilities. Like, that's what I want. I don't want a defined...
That's what we
want
to see.
Yeah, I don't want a predefined fucking endpoint destination. That sounds
boring. You can't. If you do, then it's over.
Yeah, that's the same thing as go to school, get a job, retire,
right.
You know, get a
exactly.
Winnebago and travel the country. That,
yeah.
That sounds boring as fucking hell to me. Like, I want the possibilities to be there. So anarchism,
right.
And then what, I think is a really good fucking slogan. It's a bumper sticker there, G20. Anarchism, and
right.
Then what?
I like it. And I think we can make a lot of money doing that, honestly. T-shirts, bumper stickers, cartoons.
But yeah, you know, well, we can sell it with that book, Smash Capitalism. You know, you can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah. Exactly. That's right.
So Abbie Hoffman, you mentioned Abbie earlier. One of the things
yeah.
that Abbie Hoffman said, he did use the media. That was his place. I think that's where he felt
that
most
was his tool, right?
Most effective was using the media to do pranks and do these things. And he
right.
said something really interesting. It's not even really interesting. It's not even that perceptive, but it's really funny. As he said, you know, the great thing about Up Against the Wall, motherfucker, is they're so subversive, not because of anything that they're doing, but just because nobody can even print their fucking name.
Yeah, right.
Nobody can take credit for it, and nobody could provide credit to your group in the New York Times, because they're not allowed to say Up Against the Wall, motherfucker, in the New York Times.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's pretty brilliant. Like, today we have a lot of anarchists who, you know, and myself included, who want to shun the corporate media completely from marches and actions, you know, smash the cameras, get them out of there, like, fuck them, they don't deserve us. But, you know, like, they still can say self-proclaimed anarchists, but they couldn't say, like, you know, it was the motherfuckers.
You can't even put motherfuckers in quotes.
The self-proclaimed motherfucker.
Yeah, right.
That's brilliant. It's beautiful. So what's the plan now? You've been out of the mountains, or you're still in the mountains, but you've been out of the spiritual absence of the life
right.
for 30 years. You've been 3 years into it now. Are you planning any? Are you going to do trips? Are you going to do talks to Anarchist Collective?
Yeah, I am, and I have been slowly. I've talked a few events in New York and a few universities, and there's some other things planned. People have been contacting me, wanting me to talk at different groups that in Denver, you know, they emailed me and
they got a hold of you.
Older, right? And then somebody in Berkeley wanted to send me a ticket to go talk at the university, and the New School was talking. So, I mean, I just feel like I want to be supportive of the effort. I want to play a part again, talk to people about the past and some ideas. I can't give anybody a blueprint or a plan, but I just felt like I should make myself available to answer questions or to open a dialogue. And so I'm proceeding on that. I'm trying to, and that's how this conversation came about.
Yeah,
but I was, in all honesty, a little apprehensive after 35 years of not talking to people on a social level. I wasn't really comfortable with it, and I'm slowly becoming a little more comfortable with it. I'm still, you know, a little awkward with it, but I feel it's important.
Now, what about some of the other crew from back in there, like OSHA?
He's
kind of involved with still doing some subversive shit. He's a lawyer now, right?
He's a lawyer, and he does a lot of mural art. And he wrote a book recently. And he does a lot of pro bono. He does all pro bono work for people. I mean, he's still, he's a contributor to the general effort, the general struggle. I mean, you know, but on a very personal, individual level. I don't think he's part of any group at all.
Yeah, the only thing I found on him is he's Bum's Paradise. That's the book I think you're talking about, right? About the Albany landfill?
No, he wrote a book on the family. Something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the black wall up against the black mask up against the wall, motherfucker.
No, no, the history, you know, something about. I'm not sure of the title, but I think it's refers to motherfucker as history of the motherfuckers. It's recent. It's only come out in the last year, I would say.
What's his last name?
Dubin. Neumann.
Neumann, that's right. Okay. And that's with two N's at the end. I'll find it and put it up.
Yeah, look, he's been at a few events talking about the book and.
Yeah, it's called Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, A Memoir of the 60s.
Yes, that one. That's it.
Yeah. Now, were you a part of Black Bear Ranch?
Well, I don't know what apart. I mean, we went there for different events. It was, at some point, the people there thought it would be a headquarters for a tribal understanding. And so a lot of people from my family did gravitate there and interacted there, and I attended a few quote unquote tribal gatherings of, you know, different families, and but I was not an integral part of the ranch itself.
Things have changed up there. We went up there to play and share some music and some anarchist ideas with them a couple years ago, and they fucked us and fuck them. But
yeah,
you know,
sure,
I think that
changed.
Happens, right? Like shit shifts, shit changes.
Yeah, it changes and evolves, and sometimes things become the exact opposite of what they were at or in the earlier time. And
that's about right.
You know.
So you've been following.
I have not been, as I say, I have not been out there in that world for 35 years. So I really don't. You know, it's like in 1970, I was in Copenhagen. I stayed at Christiania, and that changed. I mean, it became very different than it was in 1970. Things don't last forever. You know, they evolve, they change focus. So it's expected.
I think it would be silly if things stayed the same. I think that's what's so great about anarchism as a philosophy is it doesn't have a central ideology necessarily that remains.
Yeah, and I always say anarchism is a way of life. I really see it as a way of life.
I think that's a big thing for me is one of the things it's really easy to get stuck in is it's interesting to go over it as a socio-political theory and everything. I mean, I love it. I mean, I went to school. I fucking love that shit. But really, at the end of the day, it's a way of living. And, you know, the whole concept of decentralizing yourself.
Right.
You know, decentralizing myself, you know, or killing the cop inside, you know, like as Ralph Rouser has said so many times. That's important language because it is. It's a way of life. It's a way of seeing other people. It's fundamentally different than how we've been taught to see one another.
Right. And that hopefully will evolve to a larger consciousness. But we're not doing it thinking it must. We're doing it thinking that's what we have to do. Like we're not goal oriented. We're process oriented, I think. We want to
I totally dig that, because I mean I think that it gets too overwhelming, and it can actually stunt us when we start thinking about the planet and, you know, there's billions of people and there's so many fucking problems. And I think that amount of information, that awareness, can actually overwhelm us to the point where we don't do anything. And you know, one of the guaranteed forms of change that can take place begins with the individual, you know, begins with myself. I know for a fact that I can change myself.
Right.
And it's strangely gratifying, too, to change one's life and to make ourselves see people the other way, to be conscious of where we're eating and where we're getting our food and who we're eating with and who we're associating, you know, and just evaluating those things on a decentralized level and on a working together level and not on some, you know, business level. I mean, there's a lot of fundamental paradigm shifts that begin with ourselves, and then you know, you carry them with you in your daily life, and the opportunity comes up to share your points of view with people, and you know, paradigm shifts can happen.
Right.
So, do you have any recommendations for the youth culture of today, the anarchist groups of today? Like, anything that you can just give some sage-like wisdom to, or just like some suggestions of some sort?
You know, I'm really, really reluctant to tell people what they should do. I just rather be there with them while they're doing it. Like, try to. It's really. I'm really not in the advice game.
How about if I frame it this way, then? What do you see as missing right now?
Well, I think, personally, I think what we talked about a moment ago is reintroducing the importance of a spiritual side to the struggle. I think it's even more important today with the whole jihad consciousness that's existing part of the world, is to engage that part of humanity, the need for a life consciousness, a belief system, rather than just a material or political change. And I think, you know, the anarchists have something to offer to that. I mean, I think a lot, like, for instance, a lot of these younger people that will be attracted to that jihad mind, they, if we can show them that there's a larger picture that we're going to have to deal with, I think it will be helpful to solving some of the world problems.
How has it helped you to get in touch with and work with and live with indigenous peoples?
How what?
How has it helped you to come along in your path with anarchism and with your spirituality, combining those things to be in touch with indigenous
peoples?
Well,
because, like, spirituality was such a basic part of that life. Like, it wasn't like something grafted on. It was just there. Like, see, religion is grafted on to the mind and being of a person. But spirituality is actually the person, the being itself is spiritual. It's not grafted on. It's not an identity. Like, Native people never went around with the sense that I'm different. I have this identity. I'm a Christian or I'm a Muslim or I'm. It was just spiritual was an essence. It's like breathing.
Well, you know, I think that one of the spiritual aspects of anarchism is not only do we deal with the uncertainty of the universe, we embrace it. It's an embracing of uncertainty. I think that one because I think with specifically with Western religion, you know, I grew up in a really, really religious household, and a very sectarian Christian household, and the belief was that there are meteors flying around in space, but God would never let one hit our planet. Now, that's great for dealing with that. That's dealing with that up until the moment when the meteor hits, but it doesn't fucking matter because you're all vaporized anyway.
But if the meteor hits, then God made it hit because of the butt sex.
Or he wasn't paying attention at that moment.
Right.
He was busy.
I think it's the butt sex.
That's part of that problem is to see this creative element as anthropomorphic, like that there's actually what you would just refer to as a god, like moving things. It's so much more organic than that. It's so much less anthropomorphic. It's just this whole field of being that's. As long as we think it's some prime mover, a mover, we're not going to solve the problem. It's
so
not
wait,
a
you're telling
prime
me that
mover,
not,
it's just a movement. It's
there's
moving.
Not a hillbilly in the sky, like sitting on the clouds with a shotgun, ready to pick us off at any moment? Damn it. I was hoping for that. Counting on that.
Yeah. I know you are, but that's why, even the idea, I really feel like that terminology that some Native people, the great mystery, like in other words, it really is a mystery, rather than a prime mover. The minute go ahead.
Oh, I was just—I think you hit it, Ben. I think that, we can even bring this all the way full circle. This is the heart of anarchism: is embracing the mystery of life. Because if you embrace that mystery, and we were talking earlier about anarchism, and then what? Well, possibilities. And I think a really healthy spirituality is I'm excited whenever my paradigm shifts. I mean, I want to have lots of them.
Yeah.
I don't want to have one or two paradigm shifts.
No,
I want to have lots of them.
You will have many as you can as possible.
So I think it gets back to that whole notion of experience.
Yep.
So I'm
can't have too many experiences. You're trying what?
I'm trying to get to this song that a friend of mine recorded that I wanted to play for you. They are highly influenced by the Motherfuckers and Black Mask, and they have a music group, and they did a recording of We Can Be Together.
What's the name of the group?
It's the Garden Plot Jackals. It's like a new experimental hip hop group. The
U.S.
U.S. Yeah, and one of the members, Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg, has this thing he did on his own with a bunch of other people, collaborative projects called "Green Is the Color of Dead White Men," and I think this may be on that. That record, but I can't fucking find it. Sankey emailed it to me, but I can't find it anywhere. It's a really brilliant version of that song. Now, can you tell us, was the song directly taken from the Motherfuckers, or did the Motherfuckers make a poster of the song lyrics?
Did they make a poster what?
Did you make a poster based on the Jefferson Airplane song, or did Jefferson Airplane
The Jefferson Airplane took our poster and made a song.
That's awesome. It's a great song, and for a lot of people who don't who aren't familiar with it, tell you what I can do. It won't sound that great. I can play the Jefferson Airplane version of the song. I really wanted to play Garden Plot Jackals version, but for some reason it's not in my fucking computer, and I know he sent it to me, and it kind of pisses me off that
there,
I can't find it.
Since you, and you referenced punk, but there were a lot of punk groups in England way back in the beginning of punk that were influenced by Black Mask, and somebody wrote a history of punk in England, and they talked about that influence. I don't know the name of the book, but somebody emailed me excerpts from that book.
Well, I think a lot of people have been influenced by the actions. I mean, and I think it's because it was such a, it was silenced for so long that that even existed
right.
within the movement at all.
Right.
That all we knew of the 60s, you know, the more radical aspects was SDS and Weather Underground, and you know,
right.
the more, you know, the bigger name groups, we weren't really led into the knowledge of the motherfuckers and what you guys did. And now, as of recently, there's been books coming out, and there's been a reprint of a lot of the Black Mask stuff coming out in
right.
book form. So yeah, I think it's fucking great that stuff.
It's been translated out. Like they was translated into Russian. A Russian edition came out. Of Black Mask material and motherfucker material, and then one came out just recently in Spain, translated. I mean, there's about eight of books have come out in the last year or two of translations and appendages of our flyers and our leaflets and street leaflets and visual and graphics. I mean, it's really interesting how it's all in the last few years.
Yeah, I think that's kind of telling of the consciousness shift that's taking place right now. I think people are seeking out.
Yeah, I think so, and they're looking for something, some way, and that might be just a slight hint at a direction. You know, I would not see it as more than a hint. I mean, I'm not egotistical enough to think that it's a major blueprint. It's a hint that there's something out there that can be shifted in that direction.
And you know, to be honest, I think that the saddest thing that could happen would be anarchists of today pick up those books and try to emulate it.
Oh,
emulate
it'd be terrible.
I think it would be ridiculous. It would be completely antithetical to what it was.
It would be devastating.
About. Right.
It must continue to live. See, that's the thing about it. It's a living ideology. It has to. If you just try to emulate, it's over. It has to be a breathing, living struggle of, you know, some compendium that we haven't even thought of yet.
I definitely agree.
Otherwise, we become another situationist, you know.
I found the track. It's going to take a moment for it to finish uploading, and we have 6 minutes left in the show, so hopefully it'll only take 30 seconds or so for this to get up so we can play this track. If not, if the show cuts off at 6 minutes, I'm going to stay on the line until I can play the track. And anybody who wants to stay on the line, at the end of the 6 minutes, call in before the 6 minutes are up, and we can keep the show going for a few extra minutes and keep this conversation going. But I want to get out of the way and just say thanks so fucking much for taking the time to be on Burn tonight. It's great.
Thank you. I just enjoyed being able to communicate with you, talk with you, share some things.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to some real experience with you in the near future, as opposed to just
Yeah. You have my email, and
is there a way for our listeners to tell them about eBlast? Give that
website. Yeah, it's It's eBlast. That's e-blast.squarespace, which is the carrier, Squarespace, one word, .com. And they're I call them political haiku. They're only like a paragraph each one. There's you don't have to turn the page to read it. It's not prolonged thought. It's just a some are more poetical than others, but they're all short. They're haiku. I call it haiku, but it's not based on syllables. It's based on the screen. You don't have to turn the screen to see it. It's just all contained in one paragraph.
They seem to be almost commentary based on headlines.
They are. That's exactly it. It's like a daily yoga meditation. And it's see by using the daily event to try to find a kernel of universality.
Well, I know that, Ben, for me, it's been a great conversation just because, you know, it's always a struggle working with the diversity of anarchism and learning to just be accepting to the fact that we're just a diverse body of people like everything else, and that what makes us different is our willingness to continue loving each other and working with each other in whatever ways that we can, and honoring our differences and working around it, basically.
Yeah, and in spite of our differences.
Yeah, indeed.
And thriving on, I love this sense of difference. I mean, I think that's such a great asset to embrace difference.
That's exactly what I've been bringing up at the gatherings. Is you hear a lot of rhetoric coming from the left and from the liberal left, especially about unity. We can all be one, and we can. You know, I don't think that that's necessary. I don't think that it's necessary to unify under a banner. I think it's more necessary to come together under a bunch of banners. You know, like Subcomandante Marcos de Zapatista says that we're not looking to create a new world. We're looking to open up a thousand worlds. You know, we need as many worlds as possible.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. I have the track. It's ready to go. I'm going to play this really quick. A couple minutes left on Burn, and then we're going to stick around to say goodbye to Ben after this. But I don't know if it's the Garden Plot Jackals doing this or if it's just Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg and some friends, but who gives a shit who it is. This is their version of We Can Be Together, taken from some writings and art of Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker. Thank you.
finishing the interview, so I've been on the phone for the last hour with them. Done. Happy Mother's Day. I'll be done with this in a minute.
We can be together banging on radiators, pots and pans, and noisy electric guitars done by my tribe, who's back in St. Louis, Missouri. Love all those cats. Ben, thanks so much for sticking around with us tonight.
All right. Well, thank you.
And, yeah, it was a lot of fun, my man. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Next week, we've got some great guests coming up. Dar Jamal in a few weeks, independent anti-war reporter. Who else we got coming up, Rebel Riser?
Do what?
Who else we got coming up?
Oh, next week we have Beth Chamberlain and John Ayers, radical feminists, and the point of discussion that they want to bring in is the idea that they want to put forth, or that Beth wants to put forth, that all men are sexist and all white people are racist.
Should be interesting.
Oh, we didn't even get to touch on Valerie Solanas and the gun that shot Andy Warhol, Ben. Oh, he's gone. But I'll throw that to cap that out. I will say that the gun that shot Andy Warhol was given to Valerie by Ben Maria. So and he was the only one to stand up for her. Yeah, no big deal.
All right, thanks everybody for tuning in. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Take care, everybody, and fuck shit up and give somebody a hug. Fuck it.